High schoolers are busy, but no one's too busy to help fight cancer. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society is looking for their next Student Visionaries of the Year. Could that be your child? High schoolers who participate in this 7-week philanthropic leadership development program gain valuable life skills like project management, communication, financial literacy, and entrepreneurship. Forming strong teams behind them, they fundraise for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society in honor of a pediatric blood cancer survivor right in their local community. Most importantly, this campaign is an opportunity for high schoolers to engage in meaningful work within their community and make a real impact on the lives of blood cancer patients and their families. Sound like something your child might be interested in? You can learn more about Student Visionaries of the Year or even nominate a student at lls.org/students. That's lls.org/students.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You must be a kiss is just a kiss. A smile will forget.
Welcome to a brand new season of You Must Remember This, the podcast dedicated to exploring the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century, part of the Panoply Network. I'm your host, Karina Longworth. We have been on hiatus since last summer, so much thanks to our loyal listeners for sticking with us during the long, dark fall and early winter. If you're just finding the show, welcome. You can find our archive of over 90 episodes on iTunes or at youmustrememberthispodcast.com. Today we begin a new series of 13 episodes about 11 actresses who were active at various points between the late 1920s and the early 1980s. All of these actresses have at least two things in common. They each died, either tragically, unexpectedly, and or before their time. And they were all beautiful blondes. Welcome to our new series, Dead Blondes.
Where are you going?
To Hollywood.
Hollywood?
Did you come here for excitement?
I'm better than a human woman.
Why do you look at me that way?
It was me they're interested in. Some people think I'm a very attractive girl. You didn't create that. I'm no Frankenstein, you know.
I wonder.
It's men like you who have made me the way I am.
Would you rather I be a brunette? My dress. Do you like it?
I don't know. Such a shock to see you dressed.
I'm so alone.
Throughout the history of visual representation, blonde women have symbolized exceptionalism in a variety of ways. They've been coded as hypersexualized, icily frigid, and pre-sexually pure. Their hair itself, whether natural or bleached white or dyed with saffron, as prostitutes did in ancient Rome, has been compared to everything from gold to straw to clouds, evoking ideas of wealth, rural realness, or the afterlife, or eternal life. And because most natural blondes see their hair darken as they age, there's a primal association between blondness and youth. as if to be a blonde is to somehow defy the drag of time and everything else inevitable. And while all of these ideas can exist on their own and in combination with one another to create powerful hybrid associations, in Hollywood, blonde women are also often blank slates on which viewers are invited to project their own desires. All of this combines to make the female blonde a kind of perfect victim whose promise seems to have been all the more promising when it's cut short. This series is not meant to offer a complete taxonomy of deceased blondes in the history of Hollywood. That would be impossible. It's not even a complete history of blonde actresses who died too young. That, too, would be a tall order. Instead, through the stories of these 11 women, we're going to try to talk about two major groups of ideas. First, what has it meant to be a blonde at various stages in Hollywood history? And second, what do the special qualities associated with blondness have to do with the ways in which, for each of these women, an untimely or unusual death has become such a major aspect of their lasting image and legacy that it threatens to overshadow their work and their lives? In other words, in each of these episodes, we'll explore how a blonde beauty was perceived in life and how they fit into the larger phenomena of the beautiful, blonde, dead white woman as an iconic victim, whose tragic end somehow attains a larger-than-life quality. Our first subject is someone we've discussed briefly before, first in episode 24 on Dori Previn, and again in episode 27, which covered how Betty Davis came to found the World War II institution, the Hollywood Canteen. Here's an excerpt from that episode.
When she was 16, Betty went with her mother to see a production of Ibsen's The Wild Duck, starring an actress named Peg Entwistle as Hedwig. Entwistle became the young Betty's idol, not just her inspiration to become an actress, but a specific model that the teenage future star saw herself in. 8 years later, a short ways into Betty's own Hollywood career, Peg Entwistle committed suicide by jumping off the H in the Hollywood sign. A star on Broadway, apparently she had moved to Los Angeles from New York at the height of the Depression, and after most of her part in her first film ended up on the cutting room floor, she was unable to get a studio contract. Entwistle was immediately taken up by the press as a symbol of Hollywood's power to lure the ambitious and vulnerable and crush them with its disappointments.
This is the version of Peg Entwistle's life and death story that's most often told. A promising theater actress turned despondent failed screen diva helps turn the Hollywood sign, up until then a real estate gimmick, into a movie land icon by rendering it haunted. A lot of people have heard this story, but so little of the real Peg Entwistle is known that on page 241 of Hollywood Babylon, Kenneth Anger inserted a photo of a topless blonde model with the caption, "Peg Entwistle, skydiver." Even though the photo clearly isn't of Peg Entwistle. But very few readers of Hollywood Babylon had any idea what the real Peg Entwistle looked like. In a podcast episode about Betty Davis, I didn't have the time or the inclination to delve deeper into the Peg Entwistle story. Now, I'm taking the time to explore the truth behind one of Hollywood's foundational legends, which helped to put the wheels of the public's fascination with tragic movie blondes into motion. Join us, won't you, for our first dead blonde story, that of Peg Entwistle.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Blonde-haired, blue-eyed Millicent Lillian Entwistle was born in 1908 in Wales to English parents, who split up when Peg was two. The toddler remained with her actor father, Robert, and around 1913, they immigrated to New York. Robert Entwistle had a brief career on Broadway, then remarried, retired from acting, and opened a store selling fancy custom gift boxes. By the time Peg was a preteen, she had been bitten by the theater bug. In 1921, she went to see Laurette Taylor in the Broadway hit Peg O' My Heart, and walked out insisting that friends and family start calling her Peg. She was determined to use the access she had, living in Manhattan as the daughter of a man who had had some success on the stage, to vault herself into a career as a theatrical star. And then everything went Dickens on young Peg. First, her stepmother died of a freak illness, and then her father died of injuries sustained in a freak accident. Peg and her two much younger half-brothers were moved to Ohio and put under the care of their father's brother and his wife. Then 4-year-old Bobby Entwistle, Peg's brother, became ill, and doctors recommended that he be moved to a warmer climate. So, in 1923, the whole family moved to Los Angeles, settling in Beechwood Canyon, the road carved into the hills, delineating the eastern edge of the community that had been dubbed Hollywood. What would become the city of Hollywood had coalesced at the base of the Cahuenga Pass in the late 1880s, when Harvey Henderson Wilcox would sell the first subdivided lots registered Hollywood, California, using a name suggested by his wife, Dieta Wilcox. Hollywood, nestled into the foothills and sprawling into wide, flat streets, grew slowly over the first decade of the 20th century. The soon-to-be movie capital's population was at first composed in large part of individualists, suffragettes, retirees and refugees from bleaker climes looking to cash in on the land, and prohibitionists. One of the first laws passed by the city of Hollywood banned the selling or carrying of alcohol. But independence came at a price, and by 1909, the city of Hollywood, population 10,000, was collapsing due to problems with sewage, drainage, and water. Unable to thrive on its own, Hollywood was incorporated into the city of Los Angeles in 1910. By then, a slow exodus had begun of film producers, directors, and performers from the East Coast to the West. Cut to a decade later, when the mixed crew of Entwistles arrived, and Hollywood was overrun with pilgrims who had been lured by the gold rush-like promise of the movies, only to discover, in most cases, that there was no gold to be found. Like something out of the Grapes of Wrath, there were a lot more dreamers than there were vacancies. The industry was also reeling from a series of scandals, including the death of Olive Thomas and the trials of Fatty Arbuckle, which had implanted in the minds of a scandal-sheet-devouring public an image of Hollywood as a sin pit and death trap. As damage control, the Hollywood powers that were called in Will Hayes, who arrived in Hollywood in 1922 to create a system of filmed content vetting that would, over the next 12 years, morph into a more or less fully-fledged commercial censor. The film industry of 1923 was entirely focused on putting on a bright, happy, positive face to distract away from the underbelly that the scandals had turned into nationwide news. No wonder, then, the film industry embraced a symbol that had nothing to do with movies and everything to do with a better future. Designed to advertise a new housing development of the same name, the sign originally read Hollywood Land, all one word, in automated and timed flashing lights. First the holly would light up, then the wood, then the land. Hollywood Land. It was posted to advertise a new subdivision of land, 500 acres at the top of the mountain that overlooked the original Hollywood community, as well as Los Angeles's sprawl, miles and miles and miles to the east, west, and south. From Hollywood Land, on a clear day, you could see the edges of the coast, from Long Beach to Santa Monica, with the vague shape of Catalina Island way off in the distance, right in the middle.
Peg was home for summer break and practicing a play on the porch of her aunt's Beechwood Canyon house when the sound of trucks and tractors rudely interrupted her, carting what would become the lighted letters of the Hollywood sign. She loved her aunt and uncle, and they were good surrogate parents, but Peg was a Broadway baby with a British accent, dumped into the Wild West. She remained focused on her dream of becoming a New York stage star and seemed impervious to the allure of the movie colony, even as Hollywoodland was literally developing all around her. Peg began her acting training at the Hollywood Theater Community School. From there, her uncle Charles got her a spot in a new theater school run by the New York Theater Guild, and Peg went back to Broadway, where she believed she belonged. Before she could complete the Guild's program, Peg was lured to Boston with the promise of a 6-month contract with Henry Jewett, a stage producer whose renowned Boston Repertory Company was moving into a new theater space and was launching a new program to match. By January 1926, when 17-year-old Betty Davis would see Peg playing Hedwig in Ibsen's The Wild Duck at Boston Repertory, Peg had been in Boston for 3 months and had appeared in several plays, all hits, during that time. But it's Peg's turn as Hedwig that's remembered as the legendary performance, because Betty Davis elevated it to the status of legend by frequently repeating that it was that performance, that experience of watching an actress her own age with whom she identified totally, create a life on the stage before her eyes that made Betty determined to become an actress. When the curtain went down and the lights came up, Betty turned to her mother sitting next to her and said, "Mother, if I can live to play that part, I shall die happily." Betty would get her chance just 3 years later. Peg would triumph at the Boston Repertory for 8 months, powering through a grueling schedule of 12 performances a week. Then she burned out. She quit the repertory company, went back to New York, and was soon cast in a British comedy called The Man from Toronto. The play was met with indifferent reviews and closed quickly, making it Peg's first professional disappointment. She wanted to go back to Hollywood to see her family, but she didn't want to go home with her tail between her legs, so she started looking for more work in New York. She managed a moderate success, replacing Miriam Hopkins in a production of George M. Cohan's The Hometowners. And then Peg was cast in a play called Tommy. Bound for Broadway, Tommy made its out-of-town tryout in Boston, where Peg got the conquering hero's welcome. The play moved to Broadway, where it was a solid hit. By early 1927, the New York Times was profiling Peg as the new it girl of the stage. Easter weekend of 1927, Peg fell in love with Robert Keith, an actor 10 years her senior, and after a whirlwind courtship, they married. They eloped so fast that Keith hadn't had time to get her a ring. He used a prop from the show he was appearing in. Both husband and wife were notable enough that their pairing made the newspapers. Peg was deliriously happy. And then, 2 days later, she was sitting with her new mother-in-law in her new home. Peg asked Keith's mother about a photo of a young boy on the piano. And the mother said, "Why, that's Bob. That is your husband's little boy." Peg had not been aware that her husband had a little boy, or for that matter, an ex-wife. In fact, he had falsified their marriage certificate to state that he was single rather than divorced, and he had not said a word to Peg about his failed marriage and ongoing parental responsibility. Peg seems to have kept this knowledge to herself for months, as if hoping the bad news wouldn't be true if she didn't talk about it. Over that period, her husband ceased working as an actor, and Peg found herself supporting both her new husband and his mother. Finally, in a drunken fit of desperation, Robert Keith confessed to Peg about his previous marriage and begged her to help him pay the back alimony he owed, a delinquency which had left him on the lam from the law. The bank of Peg Entwistle was not exactly in a position to make endless loans. When Tommy ended, Peg's next play, The Uninvited Guest, flopped unceremoniously, and Peg didn't work for months after that. Amongst the career disappointments of this time was a role Peg lost to Ruth Gordon in the play Serena Blandish. To make matters more complicated, during this period she found herself pregnant, and she described the $160 price of an illegal abortion as a dear sum of money. But with no desire to have a child, the procedure itself, she explained, was a relief. As she wrote in a letter to her aunt, quote, "Needless to say, the last thing in the world I want is a child. I wouldn't do that for any man. I don't know what it is, but it must be a streak of insanity with me. I'm positively rabid on the subject. I've tried all my life to fight it, but it gets worse all the time. The doctor told me I was abnormal. At least I'm being a little bit original."
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Finally, it looked like Peg's luck had turned around. In the spring of 1929, Peg and Keith were invited to join the New York Theater Guild's touring repertory company. It was a great honor, and for Peg, it was a dream come true to be associated with the Guild as a real working actress. But it wasn't a high-paying gig, and the couple weren't exactly flush when an old catastrophe reared its ugly head. Robert Keith was presented with a warrant for his arrest. He could avoid jail time only if he paid the $1,000 in back alimony that he owed immediately. This time, Peg couldn't afford to bankroll her husband, and so he went to jail. In order to bail him out and keep him out, Peg had to grovel for a loan from the Guild to be repaid out of her own future paychecks. But at least now Keith was free to join Peg on the road to fulfill their commitments to the Guild. The tour was so eventful that Peg may have later wished that her husband had stayed locked up. In November 1928, in West Virginia, Keith was arrested for drunk driving, an incident which made the newspapers when he failed to show for his court date. A couple of weeks later, he drunkenly attacked Peg, ripping out chunks of her hair. Peg moved into her own hotel room and vowed to legalize their separation when the tour was over. But her husband made a show of drying out and cleaning up his act, and soon they were sharing a hotel room again. Robert Keith's good behavior did not last, and before the tour was over, he was fired by the Guild. Keith ended up finding work in a review in Los Angeles. When the Guild tour ended up in that city in April 1929, Keith showed up at the stage door of the theater, blind drunk. He failed to talk his way inside to see his estranged wife, and when Peg heard Keith was out there waiting for her, she felt trapped inside her dressing room. She finally got rid of him by promising to meet him the next day, when he was sober. Peg did meet her husband the next day, and then she told him she was filing for divorce. The divorce filings describe many of the ways in which Keith had done wrong. Because of Keith's actions, the filing explained, Peg, quote, became and now is sick, sore, and ill mentally, so that she is unable to continue her work upon the stage except by using her greatest efforts, and then is not doing the best she should. If she did not separate from her husband immediately, the filing suggested, Peg would become, quote, so impaired that she will be forced to stop her work. Peg was granted her divorce, and Robert Keith stayed away. In fact, he took yet another wife before his divorce with Peg was even final. And after he was out of sight, Peg returned to work with renewed focus, earning stellar reviews with the repertory company during the last few weeks of the tour. As their contracts neared an end, many members of the repertory company were signed to lucrative re-ups by the guild. But not Peg. Her marital problems, the financial dramas they had caused, and the press it all had attracted had turned her into damaged goods. And aside from honoring the stipulations of her contract by casting her in one additional New York production a couple of years later, the New York Theater Guild essentially blacklisted Peg going forward. Instead of returning to Broadway, still the street of her dreams, at the end of the tour, Peg came to Hollywood, moving into an apartment in close proximity to her family's home in Beechwood Canyon to lick her wounds. For the several months that she spent in Los Angeles, she was apparently depressed. Her family members noted that she essentially stopped talking, and one friend believed that Peg was contemplating suicide. The dark period was punctured by a ray of hope. Peg was invited to play the detective's love interest in a stage adaptation of Sherlock Holmes, which would tour the East and Midwest. From there, Peg joined a repertory company based in an exclusive resort in Maine. One of the plays Peg appeared in that summer was Holiday, with Peg taking the role of rebellious daughter Linda Seaton. This was the part that Katharine Hepburn had understudied 2 years earlier when the play debuted on Broadway. A few years later, Hepburn would play Linda in George Cukor's screen version. While Betty Davis looked at Peg Entwistle and saw a career she wanted, Katharine Hepburn had the career that Peg Entwistle might have looked at and thought, that should be mine. Several times they seemed to be tracing one another's steps. After 2 summers in Maine, Peg was cast in a New York production of Little Women, 2 years before the film adaptation, which would cement Hepburn's early stardom. And both Peg Entwistle and Katharine Hepburn were considered for the same part, a part that would bring them both to RKO Studios, but make only one of them a star. Peg had been cast opposite the legendary Laurette Taylor in a revival of James M. Barrie's Alice Sit by the Fire. Taylor was returning to the stage after a 4-year absence, so the play was highly anticipated. In fact, it was probably the highest-profile thing Peg had ever been a part of. The show was rapturously received for about a week. Then Taylor's dormant alcoholism flared up. Shows had to be canceled, and for a while, the schedule was rejiggered to replace all evening performances with matinees. But eventually, after one too many Taylor no-shows, the producers cut their losses and canceled the play's run. From the ashes of that debacle, Peg was handed an opportunity. A show called The Mad Hopes, which was to move to Broadway in the fall, was to have an extended tryout in Los Angeles. Producer Edwin Belasco had already cast Humphrey Bogart and Billy Burke, the wife of Florence Ziegfeld, and later the Good Witch in The Wizard of Oz, but he was having trouble filling the ingenue role. The producer had seen Peg during the Guild's tour stop in L.A. and wired to see if she was available. Soon Peg was on a train back to her family's home base. The Mad Hopes premiered in May at the Belasco Theater and attracted rave reviews. Peg even started casually dating her co-star Bogart. All was going swell, and when the LA run ended, Peg was invited to join the show on Broadway in September. It was in the Mad Hopes that Peg attracted the attention of the casting office at RKO. They were looking for a young lady for the lead in a film called Bill of Divorcement. Billy Burke, Peg's co-star in The Mad Hopes, had already signed on to play the older female lead, a woman who divorces her husband while he's in an insane asylum and is surprised to see him return just as she's on the verge of remarriage. The open part was for Burke's daughter, a spirited young woman on the brink of her own engagement whose vision for the future is interrupted by the return of her long-lost dad. By May of 1932, RKO had already screen-tested Katharine Hepburn for this part, at the insistence of George Cukor. Hepburn had yet to make her screen debut, but Cukor had seen her on the stage and was determined to cast her in his film. But he was the only person involved with Bill of Divorcement who wanted Hepburn. Before she was even tested, a female casting director in RKO's New York office wrote to production chief David O. Selznick, dissuading the test. As a Broadway star with some heat, Hepburn was going to demand a hefty fee if she was to make her screen debut. And it was the consensus of the New York office that she wasn't worth it. The test happened anyway, but once Selznick saw it, he wasn't impressed. He simply didn't like the look of her. On May 31st, after signing Billy Burke, Selznick wrote to Kuker and suggested that he look up Burke's co-star in The Mad Hopes, who Selznick referred to in his memo as Peggy Entwistle. Selznick hadn't seen the play, but presumably, he thought anyone would be better than Hepburn. In the looks department, Peg Entwistle was nothing like the extravagant beauties Selznick would later gravitate towards, such as Ingrid Bergman and Jennifer Jones, but she had an avian grace that Hepburn didn't have. Peg looked vulnerable in a way Hepburn didn't. And she certainly looked more like the daughter of Billy Burke than Hepburn did. Kuker obeyed the request of the studio chief, and he called Peg in for a meeting. Having played along, Kuker then refused to cast anyone but Katharine Hepburn in Bill of Divorcement. Selznick finally gave in, but he had enough interest in Peg to repurpose her, signing her to a one-picture contract. The one picture would turn out to be a quasi-supernatural thriller called 13 Women. 13 Women gets a fraction of a sentence in David Thompson's 800-page bio on Selznick, even though the film bears Selznick's unmistakable fingerprints in its stellar production value, its casting, and its key subjects, female ambition, beauty, madness, all some of Selznick's pet obsessions. The film was loosely based on a lurid paperback novel by Tiffany Thayer, who was as renowned for his laughably florid sex scenes as for his preposterous plotting. The novel and the film share the same basic story. Ursula is an outsider at an exclusive all-girls school. An orphan, referred to in the movie as a half-caste, half-Hindu, who is tormented by her waspy classmates for not being of pure white blood. Eventually, Ursula runs away from school and spends the next few years studying astrology, hypnotism, and the occult. She infiltrates a male astrologer's practice and uses him as a front to send her hated classmates letters, telling them all that the stars foretell that they will either commit murder or suicide. Ursula then makes these deaths happen through the power of hypnosis. In the novel, one of the side plots was a lesbian romance between two of the all-grown lily-white schoolgirls, Hazel and Martha. There's no Martha in the movie, but Hazel remains. That's the part played by Peg Entwistle, but the character has been radically changed. In the novel, Hazel's passion for another woman leads her to make the Swami's prediction come true. Sick with tuberculosis, abandoned by her lover, she starves herself to death. In the movie, all of this plot is gone. Though, by the way, all of the women gaze at each other, often holding hands or posing with their faces inches apart as though they're about to kiss, we get the sense that they all may be harboring secrets of sorority intimacies. We meet Hazel in the first sequence of the movie, but have no idea who she is, aside from one of the now-adult schoolgirls who have consulted the same occultist. She watches two of her schoolmates, sisters, perform their flying trapeze act, aware that one of the sisters' horoscope supposedly says that there will be an accident. Sure enough, that sister fails to catch the other sister in midair. One sister dies, and the other is institutionalized. The next time we see Hazel, she's removing a knife from the guts of her husband. She has received a letter from the Swami, promising bloodshed and a lifetime prison sentence. And she, too, has made the prophecy come true. With her almost translucent skin, frail frame, avian nose and hair the color of, as one of her family members described it, skinned almonds, Peg looks every bit the patrician daughter. In fact, one of 13 Women's in-jokes, intentionally planted or otherwise, is that while the evil Ursula, played by a pre-thin man, Myrna Loy, is absolutely stunningly gorgeous and one-of-a-kind looking. All of Ursula's victims kind of look the same. There were a couple of times when other actresses appeared on screen after Peg's character had been sidelined, and I did a double take, not sure for a second if Peg had come back. She hadn't. After Hazel kills her husband in minute 12, realizes what she's done, and devolves into madness, all in the space of a single cut, the film has no use for Peg Entwistle. Peg had taken the part and had broken her theatrical contract to perform the Mad Hopes on Broadway to do it, thinking that she'd have more to do. In fact, as 13 Women was shot, Peg Entwistle had 16 minutes of screen time. In the end, she had about four. This had little to do with Peg's performance, and she wasn't the only casualty. At least three of the 13 women had their parts cut entirely, and of those remaining, I counted only eight who actually had a name and lines. The running time of the release version of 13 Women was a shockingly scant 59 minutes. The reasons for this are simple. The division of early talkie Hollywood into pre- and post-code has led many to believe that the institution of censorship in 1934 was like flipping a light switch. But in fact, it was more of a ramp-up, beginning way back when Will Hayes' office was established in 1922. By 1932, the Production Code Administration was heavily involved in vetting scripts and finished films, and producers who wanted their films to be distributed widely had little choice but to concede to the censor's demands, or at least try to negotiate a compromise. As Hazel, Peg shot scenes with an actress named Marjorie Gateson, who was playing Martha, who in the book was Hazel's lover. In the existent scene, where Hazel greets her circus-performing friends backstage, she mentions that she's been on a trip with a friend. A scene was shot of Hazel leaving the backstage tent and meeting up with Martha. This scene implied that Hazel and Martha were more than just friends. This scene was cut. Peg's biggest day on set was the grueling 12-hour shoot of the scene between Hazel, Martha, and Hazel's husband Tom. This scene was meant to serve as the prologue to Hazel's murder of Tom. In it, Hazel would pace her bedroom, tormented by a hypnotic drumbeat in her head, the same drumbeat that accompanied the trapeze act. Then Tom comes in. The couple have an argument about Hazel's waned interest and affection from her husband. She never liked him to paw her, she insists. She just thought that she didn't have a choice. Tom eventually gives up and leaves the room. Then Martha slinks in, and an affectionate scene between the two women follows, in which Hazel confesses to Martha that she was being tormented by the Swami's prophecy. But the torment was worse when Tom was around. Martha comments that Tom is probably the problem, then soothingly suggests that they stay in that night and have a picnic in the boudoir. In the next scene, Tom catches Hazel and Martha together in the bedroom. Hazel in a negligee, Martha apparently having just put on her street clothes. Tom gets angry and threatens Hazel. "Don't touch me," she screams. "I'll touch you," he promises, "and you'll like it." She tries to get away to leave with Martha. There's a struggle, and Hazel stabs her husband with a knife from her and Martha's picnic spread. And this was all to be seen from Martha's perspective. This entire scene would be cut. Peg was called back to film a retake, the shot of her removing the knife from her husband's chest. But while doing this reshoot, she had little sense of how drastically her part would be cut out of the picture. Before anything had been shot, the Production Code Office told RKO, upon review of the script for 13 Women, that any hint of a lesbian relationship would need to be cut. Selznick decided not to listen to this recommendation, which wasn't that unusual. Some producers would tell the Hayes office they were following their script advice, then they'd shoot their original scripts anyway, and then hope that the offensive material didn't play so offensively on screen. That was the case here, and it was done relatively in the open. Though some correspondence shows RKO trying to convince the censors that the film's lesbianism had been minimized, Selznick also wrote a letter to the Hayes office's Jason Joy, noting that the studio had faith in the director's, quote, ability to treat it in a way that will be neither offensive nor objectionable. Selznick had historical precedent on his side. 2 years earlier, the Hayes office had passed the Joseph von Sternberg film Morocco, which featured Marlene Dietrich playfully kissing another woman as part of a scandalous nightclub act. There was nothing that literal in 13 Women. And in any case, the code didn't specifically prohibit lesbianism. And yet, at some point, RKO decided to play ball with the censors rather than fight them. A final code-approved cut of 13 Women was completed by the beginning of September. Within 2 weeks, RKO declined to extend Pegg's contract. On September 16th, 2 days after news that Pegg had been dropped by RKO made the papers, Pegg told her uncle she was taking a walk to the local drugstore and planned to see some friends after. The next morning, she still hadn't come home. By the time she had been gone for 24 hours, her family really started to worry. 24 hours after that, with Pegg still missing, the LAPD got a report from a woman who had stumbled across a woman's jacket and purse while hiking in Beechwood Canyon. She had looked down from where she had found these things and had seen a body crumpled at the bottom of the hill. This anonymous caller said she had dropped the woman's things on the steps of the Hollywood Police Department. Then she hung up the phone. The police found the jacket and the purse, inside of which there was nothing but a note. It read, "I'm afraid. I'm a coward. I am sorry for everything. If I had done this a long time ago, it would have saved a lot of pain." The note was signed P.E. The cops rushed to the area the hiker had described at the base of the Hollywoodland sign. There, quite a ways down the hill, they found a female corpse. The detectives concluded that this woman had climbed the ladder attached to the back of the H of the Hollywoodland sign and had hurtled herself off, smashing her pelvis on impact with the hillside and then rolling down into the bottom of the ravine. She suffered many broken bones and internal bleeding. She probably hadn't died instantly, and certainly not painlessly.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter your search based on the qualities that are most important to you. Then you can book a free 15-minute consultation call with any therapist you're interested in seeing, so you can get a feel for whether they're the right fit before you commit to a full-length session. Alma also makes it easy for mental health care providers to navigate insurance. That's why 95% of therapists in their directory accept insurance for sessions, so you can find care that's affordable without stressing about the paperwork. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy60 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy60.
The next day, all of the local newspapers ran stories about the body and the note. The police had no way of identifying the body, so they described the corpse's features and asked the public for help. Pegg's family saw the stories, and they knew. It was her. P.E. was their Pegg. Her uncle Charles went to the police station and then the morgue, where he positively identified the body. Charles was interviewed, and then the LAPD and the coroner agreed on a cause of death: suicide due to despondency. But why was Pegg so suicidally despondent? Sure, she had been largely cut out of her first movie and dropped from her first film contract, but she had never had ambitions to be a movie actress. She always wanted Broadway fame. Her uncle Charles had said something to reporters in the police station about how Pegg was upset that she had failed to click at RKO and the reporters turned this into a story which they knew would sell, about a failed Hollywood aspirant's desperate dive to her death. But Peg wasn't a failed Hollywood aspirant. She wasn't a Hollywood aspirant. She was a moderately successful stage actress whose last theatrical effort had been a triumph. However, she had burned bridges with the powerful producers of The Mad Hopes in order to take the part in 13 Women. And those producers had told other producers that Peg was bad news, which the Theater Guild clearly already believed after the trouble Peg caused them with her marriage. When she was largely cut out of that movie, due to no fault of her own, but instead thanks to Selznick's losing gamble with the censors, and dropped by RKO, she could have just gone back to New York and to Broadway had she not wrecked her reputation in the theater world by taking the movie contract in the first place. Plus, in Peg's absence from New York, her roommate and close female friend had been unable to pay the rent on their apartment and had been forced to move out. Peg's clothes and furniture had been seized in lieu of back rent. She must have felt that she had no home to go back to in New York, and no prospects of work there. And the rejection by RKO made staying in Hollywood and trying to find more work in movies seem terribly frightening. Almost as scary as going back to New York, where she perceived that the whole theatrical community hated her. According to Peg Entwistle's family, a few days after Peg's body was identified, a letter arrived at her uncle's house, addressed to Peg. It was from RKO. It requested that Peg come back to the studio. They had found another role for her. Thanks for listening to You Must Remember This. This episode was written, narrated, and produced by Karina Longworth. That's me. Our research and production assistant is Lindsay D. Schoenholtz, and our editor is Sam Dingman. Our logo was designed by Teddy Blanks. You can find more information about this episode and other episodes at our website, youmustrememberthispodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter at RememberThisPod. And if you like the show, please tell anybody you can, any way that you can. Subscribing on iTunes and rating and reviewing us there really helps the show to move up in the charts on iTunes, which helps other people find it. We'll be back next week with another tale from the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century. Join us then. Won't you? Good night.
You know the Hollywood sign that stands in the Hollywood hills. I don't think the Christ of the Andes ever blessed so many ills. The Hollywood sign seems to smile like it's constantly saying cheese. I doubt if the Statue of Liberty ever welcomed more refugees. Give me your poor, your tired, your pity.